I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a $5,000 matching grant that will double your gift today to jumpstart giving to help close a $94,000 funding gap before the end of our financial year on June the 30th. This show depends fully on the generosity of listeners like you to bring you this podcast and so many other resources to strengthen your faith. So I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now to help close this gap, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/unbelievable. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievable. Thank you.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, I'm here with background thumping noises because we've got workers in our house. So apologies in advance for any disruption from my end.
And we're really pleased to have a guest on the show today, which is Brian Brock. How are you, Brian?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Oh, it's great to have you on. For those who haven't come across your work, would you mind kind of introducing yourself and give us a little flavour about what you do for your day job?
I'm a professor of moral and practical theology at the University of Aberdeen, where I am right now. And I have really specialised in questions around ethics of technological development, which came out of studying medical ethics early on, and also questions around disability and probably the other main heading is the kind of use of the Bible in Christian ethics.
Brilliant. And did I see correct on Wikipedia, you had a brief stint in the noble profession of journalism right at the very beginning
of
your career?
I did, yes. Yeah, I did a year working as a journalist in oil country in Texas, and I really enjoyed it and was tempted to stay in it. But my sense was it would take about 10 or 12 or 15 years to get to do the stuff I really wanted to do. And I thought that was a big investment.
Fair enough.
And then, Brian, we met one another, didn't we, through your wife, who I was working with me as a neonatal nurse in the neonatal unit at UCH. And I discovered that her husband was some kind of wonky theologian type. So that was a great discovery, and we did some work together. We had long discussions, I remember, about medical ethics and theology and so on.
Yes. Yeah, I remember sitting on a bench in London when I, in pre-beard days as a graduate student, being very enlightened. And I was, last time we saw one another was kind of connecting to the topic of our discussion today was this pandemic workshop, and you put in a plug for the Pit, which Stephanie and I have now watched at least the first series, and that certainly provokes lots of questions around the medical world, life and death, pandemic, its effects. So it's been a long and fruitful relationship, John.
And me too. And so the close reason for inviting you on the podcast is, as you said, we were both invited participants in a workshop held by the Faraday Institute, which was a fascinating occasion over a weekend of a range of people all involved in the COVID pandemic responses, including those who were involved in emergency responses within Number 10 Downing Street and elsewhere. And it was really, the focus was to discuss how the church responded in retrospect, have a kind of retrospective review of what actually happened and how the church responded. And in the process, you presented a paper which I found absolutely fascinating on Luther and Luther's response to plague in his time. And I thought that was such a fascinating topic that I'd love to invite you onto the podcast, really just to explore that with you, what you learnt from studying Luther. It's not the sort of thing that most of us do. and why you chose Luther, and how his experiences and teaching might be relevant to us today.
Yeah, I'm delighted to. How did I get to this? I have drawn a lot from Luther over the years for a range of reasons, and one piece that I've found of his work that is not much engaged but was really important to him was a series of lectures he did at the end of his life, basically passing on his vision of theology to his students. And he did it as a lecture through the entire book of Genesis. It took him years, and he did it every day for a couple hours, and stenographers took it down. So it was really in the context of engaging with that project that I discovered that we have a live record of the plague hitting Wittenberg. So Wittenberg was where the Reformation kind of coalesced. Luther's house was there, and it was associated with a university overseen by a guy named Elector John, who was basically the authority in the region, the prince who had control of the region, and he protected Luther and the university. So we have a kind of hothouse of the evangelical Reformation, and people have come from all over Germany to study theology with Luther and Melanchthon and a few other theologians. And in 1527, the plague began to rumble through Germany, and so Luther started to get letters from pastors saying, "How do we handle this?" And Luther's project in general is to try to work his own theological insights through the whole range of things that Catholic theologians and canonists would have been saying about how you should negotiate, you know, life in all its breadth. And medieval Christianity was, you know, very well developed. So if you're going to take this new theology seriously, then it should make a difference to how people respond to this life and death situation. And people kept asking him, "Tell us what to do." After several months of getting those letters, he started to draft an essay, which later was released under the title "Whether One May Flee a Deadly Plague." And in that, he began to set out what essentially a kind of a spiritual stance toward this kind of threat, how to understand it, what biblical text to draw on, what your responsibilities are, whether you need to stay, and no matter what, life or death. So that's the broadest scope of the essay.
So that's really interesting. So what you're saying is that one of the remarkable and important facts of the whole Reformation was that it put much greater focus onto normal everyday living.
That's right.
Rather than life being divided into the religious and the rest, and it was really only the religious, the people who were in the monks and the nuns and so on, the priests, that they were the most important thing. That one of the most important factors of the Reformation was that it was people's everyday life that was important. It was making decisions, practical decisions. How did you use the Bible? How did you use theology to make those decisions? And so along comes the plague, and all of a sudden, yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it?
And there's a one of Luther's famous theological moves was to reject the distinction between sort of councils and prefects. So the, you know, there's a higher way that the monks and the ordained people need to follow. But then the common people essentially have a lower standard. And that was tied to the Latin term for what the Good Samaritan does when he hands the hurt man off to the inn owner. He says, you know, I'll pay for his care and whatever else besides, right? And that the Latin term for whatever else beside became the hook for supererogatory acts, which were not necessary, right? So it's a good thing that he did that, and it's a good thing that he paid for whatever else besides, but not every Christian is responsible to do that extra supererogatory act. And so Luther had famously already attacked that. So when the plague comes, the obvious question is, well, do we have to stay behind and risk our lives? Is that now what everybody has to do? Or is that just the higher way for people who are, you know, really spiritual? Like, how do we navigate this? So I think that's why the questions were very much in the air.
It's really interesting because, as it happens, the very first ever episode of this podcast came out a week or two into the COVID pandemic in 2020. And the first episode, we had started talking about doing the podcast before everyone had ever heard of COVID, but we couldn't get round to it until we were all locked down in our houses from fearing the coronavirus, as we then called it. And the very first episode was a kind of exploration and discussion of how the church has responded throughout history to different episodes of plagues and pandemics. And in particular, Dad was sharing some things he'd read from a historian called Rodney Stark, who's kind of tracked some of the growth of the early church. And makes the case that it was the kind of distinctive and sacrificial way that early Christians in the Roman Empire refused to follow the kind of elites of the time in fleeing for the hills and retreating to summer estates to hide from the plague. But they stayed in the kind of filthy inner urban cores, tending to the sick. And, you know, there are contemporaneous accounts saying how many Christians and church leaders died while they were tending for the sick. So is that well known in Luther's time, that there is this history of Christians kind of sacrificially walking into the fire, as it were, and losing their lives in the process?
Well, this kind of turn to everyday life and the rejection of the higher and lower ways of discipleship is a reform movement, right? Like, basically, Luther was applying monastic ethics to all of society. He was popularizing the higher way, but he was doing so under the influence of, you know, reading the church fathers, right? So there was a kind of ressourcement of the contemporary theology by going back to ask how did the kind of primitive church handle these issues. So he doesn't in this specific essay appeal to those texts, but he certainly knew that the core issue was how do we interpret, you know, unless you've done it to the least of these, you haven't done it to me, right? He knew that was the key text, and he there's a lovely passage where everybody says where Luther says everybody thinks that if they came across the Virgin Mary with the plague, they would, you know, stop and help her out, but that's just self delusion. If you won't care for your own, for your neighbor that's right there in front of you, you also wouldn't care for the Virgin Mary. Because the routines of evasion that you're using to escape caring for your neighbor, your actual neighbor, would, of course, be in force if you ran into the ill and dying Virgin Mary. And all of those are just ways to evade the fact that if you have not cared for the sick who's there before you, then you have not cared for Christ. And that's, I think, what drove the early church, and I think Luther's well aware of that, and he's trying to bring that sensibility back into a medieval Christianity that had developed for a range of understandable reasons distinctions that allowed tiers of risk and responsibility.
So was the classic understanding before Luther at this point that if you're one of those monks or religious, if you're a bishop or a priest, you might be called by God to stay in the city and tend to the flock at cost of your own life. But ordinary, everyday lay Christians, they were free from this obligation and they could save their own skins. Is that, in broadly speaking, what would have been the kind
speaking,
of
I think that's the view that's of the way day. It would be understood. And that's tied to the fact that in the earliest period, one of the things that's going on in Christianity is a re-narration of the relationship between the ministry and medicine. medicine in, you know, the first Christian centuries was really a very elite affair, and a pagan affair. So Christians are trying to think about what of this do we take on board, and how do we understand even, you know, that we still have the snake on the pole, right? That was a reference. It was repurposed as a reference to Moses, but it was originally a reference to Asclepius, the kind of god of the Greek god of healing. So in this early patristic period, there was a few famous experiments in repurposing baths and almshouses as hospital. So the idea of the hospital was invented in this period, and that was seen as essentially a monastic outreach, and not anything that the average Christian would even be thinking about. But it was kind of generating institutions by out of this idea that if you've walked away from the sick, you've really walked away from Christ in his need.
And one of the, I mean, I am fascinated by this. Of course, you know, it's very close to home for Christian doctors. And of course, it is something that many of us are well aware that the roots of medicine is in this pagan, the healing, the
magic.
Well,
you still take the Hippocratic Oath, don't you? I mean, that's quite obviously pre-Christian.
Yes, absolutely. And so one of the fascinating things is the way that the Hippocratic Oath was then Christianized. And it was, although it probably came out of a kind of Pythagorean mystery cult, it's seen remarkably as consistent with a Christian perspective. But I'm also fascinated by the creation of the idea of the nurse, which is, I think, a distinctively Christian idea that the ancient world didn't have. The idea, of course, they had the idea that there were servants and skivvies who did the dirty jobs, but the idea that this doing a dirty job could be something amazingly distinguished and Christ-like, and a monastic calling, I think is a wonderful invention of that period.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, I mean, to jump back to the medieval period again. It seems to me the way that Luther's talking about responding to people that have the plague is really within the orbit of what we would call nursing. Even doctors really didn't have the ability to cure it, it seems like. So sure. So it's just there's two parts to the piece. The first part was written before the plague actually arrived, and the second part was written, and there's some pretty, as Luther is wont to do, punchy phrases. And he's really irate about people being left to die like dogs and pigs in their house by themselves, dirty, alone, you know, just kind of in a fetid last few days. And that really gets to him. And it seems to me that that's this kind of nursing impulse, right? You're not going to cure this person, but you cannot leave them. It's an unchristian thing to be prepared to save your own skin at the cost of leaving people to just die in totally squalid circumstances.
Absolutely right. But also, interestingly, one of the things that happened in the early plagues is that although many of the people who were doing the nursing died, many of the victims survived. And that's because if you do provide really excellent nursing care, you give the best possibility for people to recover. And, you know, so it's still the case, and it's the case still in the 21st century that excellent nursing care massively changes your chance of survival, quite irrespective of sophisticated medicine or not. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that, I think in many respects, that was basically the first insight and why the Basilidad is the first attempt at this, the hospital idea, basically it was a health spa, right? Like it was the baths, which were in a Roman context, they were kind of for pleasure, but also just healing in the way that we go to the bath today. But it had a quite different, it wasn't a medical, domain. It was made into a medical domain in a monastic context. So we're seeing shifting of all types of social forms, roles in institutions, and also even how the infrastructure is morally coded. I think we're getting another readjustment in the medieval period when the Reformation happens. And I think I read the plague piece in the first instance because it's paired in Luther's works with some other pieces where he's trying to think about how social care is provided. How do we care for the poor? Right. He really, in the same way, he was really offended by plague sufferers being left to die on their own. He was also offended by there being any beggar in Christian, you know, in Reformed cities. He thought it was a responsibility of the rulers to make sure that people had a kind of safety net. So he invented a new institution called the Common Chest. Again, the church also ran the schools, so he had to write the same kind of institutional reframing of what schooling was about and how to understand it and how to pay for it. And so the plague is part of a pretty broad theological chewing through what this universal Reformed faith looks like in practice.
So give us the kind of the answer then. He writes a piece, is it permissible for Christians to flee from the plague? Am I correct in guessing that his answer is broadly no? Or is it more complex than that?
Interestingly, his answer is broadly yes, unless you have responsibilities. And he has an idea commonly referred to as the three estates, which has to do with the political rule, rule in the church, and rule in the household. Those are very flexible concepts. They come out of Aristotle, and he develops them in his own way. But it's how he ties together a range of strands of the biblical tradition. And so he basically says, if you're a Christian, God does not want you to put your hand in the fire. He does not want you to stay in a burning house. He does not want you to just not paddle if you're drowning, right? God is fully on side for you to do what you need to do to protect yourself, but with the significant caveat that if you have responsibility for other people's well-being, you cannot leave unless you have covered your responsibilities somehow. So if you are the magistrate overseeing this town, if you leave, the risk of sort of looting and social chaos comes with your leaving. So you can't leave unless you set in place somebody to take that responsibility. And he then works that across these different domains. If you're responsible for the health of the community, in other words, you're a doctor, you can't leave either. And if you're responsible for the provisioning of the community, right? So he's working out from the kind of one-on-one logic of caring for the needy is caring for Christ to a social logic by way of this the concept of the three estates that allows him to map clusters of wider responsibilities that cover different layers of how society holds together.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it immediately makes me think of the COVID-19 pandemic and the definition of an emergency worker. Hmm. You know, if you're an emergency worker, you're valuable. You've got
key worker status was quite coveted, wasn't it? Because you could leave your house when all the rest of us were cooped up inside.
Yeah, I do think he hits on essentially a kind of essential perennial job of political governance is locating who needs to do what, and he's trying to do that theologically, working from this basic claim that you're in the need of the neighbor, you meet Christ, but not letting that just be individualized and random, right? Like he's like the need of the neighbor is also looked after by those who keep social institutions functional. And that doesn't mean that they should go needlessly expose themselves to infection, but their responsibilities, if they were ever for the good of the community, remain, and they should be pursued in a thoughtful way. And he on the basis of this logic, it also allows him to say, we need to keep institutions of care and even quarantine functioning, so the people responsible for doing that need to be in post. And if you are staying in a zone of infection, you need to observe those, right? So he even has an account of the importance of quarantine policy.
So even then, and this is in the 1500s, they had a reasonably decent understanding of the fact that this, they didn't know the exact precise mechanism maybe of how the plague spread, but they knew that if you spent too much time with someone who was sick, you would get sick, and then you could then spread it even before you were symptomatic. You might be then spreading it to other people.
That's right.
Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June the 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $94,000 by that date. The great news is generous friends of the ministry have offered to match the first $5,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. That's why I wanted to take just a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/matters-of-life-and-death. That's premierinsight.org/matters-of-life-and-death. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And do we know how it's actually worked out when the, because he starts writing this when the plague is kind of on the horizon, eventually does it reach Wittenberg himself? How does it work out in that city or in these kind of new reformed kind of neo-Protestant polities?
In Wittenberg, the political authority, Elector John, ordered Luther and the whole university to leave for another city, Jena, which is about 80 miles away. And when Jena itself was threatened, he ordered another move. And it stayed there for a full 8 months afterwards. So there was a kind of relocation program put in place by the legitimate political authority, which Luther admitted he was the legitimate political authority. Luther, however, himself stayed and continued his lectures. His wife, Catherine von Bora, was pregnant at the time, and many of his friends and intimates died in the outbreak. And he openly admitted in letters to his friends, and this is a quote, that he had battles without and terrors within and really grim ones. Christ is punishing us. It's a comfort that we can confront Satan's fury with the word of God, which we have and which saves our souls, even if that one should devour our bodies, right? For him, it really was also a piece of spiritual warfare, and that there were Catholic polemicists at the time who were attacking Luther and those who held to the Reformation faith for fleeing. It's like, if you really believe, you should stay and, you know, take your chances with God. So Luther's kind of navigating both a kind of public health emergency and also a religious dispute. This is only 10 years after the 10th anniversary of the 95 Theses being nailed on the door happened during the plague. in his bubble in his house. They, you know, raised a glass on that on that anniversary. So this is really a very new thing that's going on.
Yeah. So was I right in hearing you that he said that Christ is punishing us and the devil is attacking us? That both of those things he saw in the plague, both of those realities. Is that right?
Yeah. He had a, throughout his theology, and this is something that often makes people really nervous, he really took seriously the idea of temptation and even testing in the biblical sense. So he would never say, fall into a kind of Manichaean binary that this has to be the devil. The whole thing is the devil, right? That's the alternative position. If you're going to say it's not strictly naturalized event and the heavenly realms are involved at all, then your choice is to either say the devil's the only one responsible for, or the devil and God have some role to play. One of the reasons this is important is that Luther does bring this in very subtly at a range of points. To get across the point that there is a spiritual discipline in staying and fighting the fear, and that's something that's a trial in the New Testament sense, that our fear can cause us to run from our own responsibilities, and God wants to grow our faith, and so from as a trial, it's sent by God to give us clarity about what we're doing when we actually, quote unquote, take our life in our own hands to be responsible, right? Like it's not just an evil tragedy. It's also a space where we begin to see in a way that we never saw before that in this act of caring, even though my life is at risk, I know in a way I couldn't under more mundane circumstances that God is pleased with me, right? So it because it's something God is sending and allowing us to kind of step up to a higher level of faith, it also becomes a higher level of comfort because the Christian who's involved in that place can know that it's a good work, which for Luther is a technical term, right? Like when Paul is talking about a good work, he says it's the work that is genuinely pleasing to God. It doesn't mean that it's without its faults and even sin, but that God has asked us to care for the sick and dying. And if we're doing that, we know in a way that we really don't know in normal life that God is really looking down in pleasure to us. And that's a level of certainty that I think Luther took really seriously.
And how, I don't know whether you kind of ended your research there, but did you have you tried to tease out what lessons we might learn 500 years later as churches still, as we all know to our cost, still live through pandemics, what the ancients would call plagues? Do you feel like there are elements of Luther's theology that would be useful for us to attend to today?
Well, I think he doesn't fall into the a lot of the bifurcations that came up among Christians around pandemic. Like his sort of opening move is to say there's a running from death that is disobedient and one that's obedient. Jesus at the crucifixion doesn't run from death, but there's lots of examples of people sort of running from death, you know, doing the opposite of what Daniel does, right? Like standing up and doing what should be done, even if it's at risk to life. So he raises a question around how our faith is working that's different than if you believe, you're going to stay and risk it all. Or if you don't believe, you're going to, you know, run, right? And that, I think that's the kind of crass debate that was happening at his time. And he's trying to say something a little more supple, which is admitting that I'm afraid and don't want to stay and risk my own life, but that there is a kind of comfort and a promise for that faith situation. And also, if I've been responsible and kind of tried to live within the strictures of precaution, and also look after those I'm responsible for, I can admit I don't want to risk here. I don't want to do more. I don't want to kind of lean into this. I'd rather go. And that he doesn't downplay that, right? Like he basically says there's a range of positionalities for those with Christian faith, and that we should take that faith seriously. It should grow, and it should support the social order that cares for everyone. But it's not kind of the kind of anti-vax, anti-mask, you know, we're going to go to church no matter what. Those very kind of crass positions seem to dominate what Christians took to be the kind of bright line positions. And I think Luther offers really quite a helpfully different set of bright lines.
So one of the issues which came up, wasn't it, was very much about church services. It was discussed in the workshop that the powers that be had decided that church attendance was a kind of at the lowest level of priority. It was a kind of entertainment activity, mm-hmm. Of no real significance for society, and therefore, you know, stopping people going to church was really of very little consequence. And the question in retrospect was, were Christian leaders too complicit in accepting that? Should they have, you know, risked civil disobedience in order to stress the importance of communal worship and so on, mm-hmm. and particularly Holy Communion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, globally, well, at least in the United States, the church and state separation led to a good swath of conservative Christians taking this as a church-state dispute, and therefore insisting on gathering for collective worship in order to resist state overreach. I think Luther would have been real uncomfortable with, again, that way of putting the bright lines, right? Do Christians obey or disobey state guidelines, and on what grounds? And I think that those are the questions that Luther's asking, and he's asking it from the side of what guidelines should Christians fight for in their society, and how should they live in their society, no matter what its configuration. And those never, for him, broke down into we need to protect the church from illegitimate meddling by the state, or as a, you know, I think the kind of British response tended to be complete capitulation, as if the word, being fed by the word and communion, is not real feeding, right? Like there's British churches, I think, put in the broadest terms, their ministers didn't find the voice to say that man is not fed by bread alone, and our life is not our the highest good, and that has implications for how we gather. The kind of binary of gathering or not gathering as the only question of what Christians should do, the Atlantic seemed to divide into precisely opposite answers. And I think Luther gives us an example of trying to think at different levels that connect the gospel to social policy and practice that were not existing. I look at, in the essay, I look at Daniel Defoe's Journal of a Plague Year, which is, you know, a kind of retelling from the on the basis of some personal experience of the last plague in London. And he gives an example of fleeing from the plague, and that, you know, in the first person, you know, he tells the story of, I had this debate, and then I said, well, I looked at the signs of the times and saw that I really should. God is really wanting me to go because this is getting worse and worse, and you should read history. He's kind of also, he's telling his own story as a way of guiding Christians for the next pandemic as well. And he's basically saying, read the times. And then he decides to go, and he can't find a horse, and his servant runs. So then he decides to stay. And he's having a dispute between he and his brother, who says, you're just being a fatalist, and God doesn't want you to go stand in front of a truck. You know, you should save yourself. And it's finally resolved for Defoe in the narrative by him kind of flipping open the Bible and finding a passage that says, God will be with you. And I think Defoe's gives us an example that there is a kind of Protestantism that actually doesn't have much theological machinery to work with, right? It basically boils down to a biblical coin toss or a reading the tea leaves of historical events. And I think for me, Luther is helpful in that he just has a lot more ideas running, a lot more biblical themes being brought to bear. And he is offering also kind of, he's modeling positive religious coping as one of our pandemic sort of Cambridge meeting participants put it. So he offers prayers that people should pray, right? Like in this essay, there's a little block which contains, okay, here's the prayers, and there's prayers for those who, and here I'm reading, if he feels bound to remain where death rages in order to serve his neighbor, let him commend himself to God and say, Lord, I'm in your hands. Though you've kept me here, your will be done. I'm a lowly creature. You can kill or preserve me in this pestilence in the same way as if I were to flee fire or water or drought or any other danger. But if you're free and can escape, this person can commend himself to the Lord and say, Lord, I'm weak and fearful. Therefore, I'm running from evil and I'm doing what I can to protect myself from it. I'm nevertheless in your hands in this danger as in any other which might overtake me. My flight alone is not going to succeed of itself. Right. So that I think that that sense of walking Christians through how they would address God and how that would shape their emotional reactions and their practical actions, I think is just, it's orders of magnitude more supple than we managed, I think, Christians in contemporary English-speaking world. I think in that sense, it's a real challenge for us to kind of have more nuance and modalities of thinking when the next one comes.
Yeah, that's so interesting, isn't it? And I think, you know, your analysis is right, that we've got these two different responses. In the States, it was a kind of libertarian, I'm just going to do my thing and blow everyone else. And it's in the UK, it was a kind of craven shrinkage into, you know, whatever they say, you know, we'll obey. We don't really think about it. And what you're drawing out from Luther is a much more sort of, as you say, thoughtful, theologically informed, nuanced,
sophisticated.
Sophisticated, yeah. And I mean, why did it happen in the UK so badly? I suspect because it had never crossed anyone's mind that they might be forced to make this kind of, you know, church leaders, theologians, advisors, synods, you know, no one ever really thought this might be an issue. Is that fair, Tim?
Yes, I think so. I mean, even the government's own documents reveal that they had no plans for some kind of nationwide lockdown. It wasn't part of their pandemic response training. And when they initially did consider it, you know, a week or two before they had to put it into place, the advice they got was that it would only last a couple of weeks before kind of social order broke down. So this was genuinely unprecedented in the sense that neither the state nor church had any sense that they would have to think through what would it mean to be live in a society in our kind of free, democratic Western nations where the government was literally prohibiting you by the force of law from gathering for Sunday worship. So I have a degree of sympathy in the sense that church leaders and denominations were having to react on the fly to a situation that they could have no prospect of foreseeing. And what I like about what you're saying, Brian, is that Luther seems to be embracing the complexity of the situation. It's not, that doesn't lend itself to kind of simplistic black and white answers. And I think, you know, any conversation about whether we gather and whether we defy the government has to also reckon with the fact that we were dealing with a virus in which was profoundly dangerous, and you could be an asymptomatic carrier and have no idea, and you turn up to church to feed from the word and to proclaim your freedom as a follower of Christ and accidentally kill three other grannies in the pew behind you. That doesn't seem like what God wants from his people. So, and I was frustrated that so much of the debate was simply framed around this black and white thinking of, do we obey the law? Do we break the law? Is in-person worship valuable? Is it unimportant? When actually there was always other layers around, what does it mean to quarantine yourself? And what does it mean to love your neighbor in a time of an invisible pandemic? These weren't easy or obvious questions to answer.
And I think that another piece of the why it fell into such a binary, obey the government or not, is that there was another layer that I would have liked Christian leaders and pastors to engage more intelligently, which would be the logics by which church was being paralleled with other social organisms. And my recollection, and you guys will correct me if I'm off on this, was that churches were almost always mentioned alongside pubs and cinemas.
Yeah, I think they were below garden centres in the list of priority organisations to reopen. Yeah, Britain can't survive without its garden centres, right. But churches were alongside, you know, as you say, nightclubs and bars. Yeah,
the middle classes has its priorities, and garden centres come near the top.
I really was pained that Christians couldn't say, well, there are some distinctions, and actually you want churches as places where people are prepared to go above and beyond what even might be in their own interest. And you know, if church could be recognized as a voluntary group organized by a different logic than a garden center, and if Christians were actually articulating that, I think that would have been a substantive gain, even if the policy was totally as it ended up playing out. Yeah, okay, well, you know, even if Christians took the chance to say, we don't want anybody to be infected, but granny who's willing to come and have communion at the risk of her life is a different act than being willing to go down to the pub to have a pint and a fag at the risk of her life. And that as ministers of the gospel, we can tell you why those are different things, even if they don't change policy. I think that window was unfortunately really missed, and missed badly.
It would have been quite a profound witness, wouldn't it, to a watching society, which would have been, I think, incredulous, uncomprehending at why these crazy Christians would risk their lives just to have a sip of wine and a wafer. But as you say, it might have been an opportunity to say something quite profound about what the church believes about the physicality of our gathering. I think that's the other strand that I think was often not wrestled with. Is I think this would have been a different conversation if the pandemic had taken place 30 years earlier and there was no widespread, easy access, broadband, internet-enabled kind of video conferencing technology. But I think the reason it was challenging is that particularly kind of low church evangelical Protestants had spent 50 years telling people the church is not the building, it's the people. We don't need to be tied to these physical structures. And then suddenly we were forbade to go to our physical structures, but we could still meet online. And I think that really muddied the waters because people were like, well, it's not like the government is banning us from worship. We're just having to do this kind of disaggregated, disembodied worship. And then we got kind of lost in, is that the same thing? Is it inferior? Is it just as good? Can you do communion online? And I think that made it hard for the church to kind of recognize that maybe it needed to fight harder to get back in person, because some people actually quite thought they hadn't missed out on anything at all.
Yeah, one of the things I really remember, it's in the second lockdown and all that I think the illogicalities and the bizarre sort of stupid things. So do you remember that? Well, that was stuff about singing. You know, you couldn't sing. You could go, but you know, as though, and that was because some public health, some virologist had done, you know, taking a professional singer, you know, belting it out, and then working out how far, you know, the virus spray
the droplets
came.
Went, yeah, exactly.
And, you know, comparing that with the kind of mumbling which normally goes on in Christian worship. But I think it's the same kind of thing, that actually, in retrospect, corporate singing and worship at a time of life-threatening and life-changing disaster is profoundly important, and to stop people from singing, you know, actually you need a very strong reason to do that. But it did feel that there was a huge lack of leadership to me, that if the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Roman Catholic Archbishop and the head of the Free Churches and various people had got together and said, you know, we as church leaders, you know, we have this message to the nation, we call people to prayer, we, you know, etc., etc. Instead, there was just a vacuum which got filled by politicians and by medics with their slides. Next slide, please.
Yeah, it felt like the all the decisions were made by science, meaning that the political decisions were parroted, you know, it's a political decision what you're going to do with the science in any case, right? What the policy is that you roll out is not dictated by any science. And, you know, if you know anything about how those discussions happen behind closed doors, they were difficult ones because the science didn't produce a straightforward policy. It was every day debated what the policy should be. So I think one of the reasons that I use the example of the old lady who would prefer to risk death to come to church and sing and have communion is that a church that is thinking hard about what that act of faith is and how it relates to the community of the church would be one position to say some different things about how care homes were handled and the kinds of really grueling separation that were put in place there, right? So I do think that there is a way to say, take care in prudential measures, and also recognize that prudential measures do not exhaust what Christian faith means under these kind of circumstances. I mean, that does bring, John, you were, I think Luther says that there's a fear of fleeing what it costs to care for our neighbor. That is one temptation in these periods. Like this, we're just going to let others suffer because it might be costly to us in one way or the other. The other temptation is rash recklessness, to disdaining medicine, scoffing quarantine measures, mocking the measures that prove to in order, you know, safety measures in order to prove that you have faith. And Luther's trying to say those are both unchristian. And they're both sort of they're either cowardly or prideful, and what he wants to get across then is we are living through basically a house fire or a city fire. So when people either flee or are rash, both of those endanger the city. And I'll just sort of read from him. He said, when people are either falling to the sin of fleeing illegitimately or being rash, they behave as though a house were burning in the city and nobody were trying to put the fire out. Instead, they give leeway to the flames so that the whole city is consumed, saying that if God so willed, he could save the city without water to quench the fire. No, my dear friends, this is no good. Use medicine, take potions which can help you, fumigate house, yard, and street, shun persons and places wherever your neighbor doesn't need your presence or has recovered, and act like a person who wants to help out, put out the burning city. What else is an epidemic but a fire which, instead of consuming wood and straw, devours life and body? So he's trying to give us alternative imagery to think about what we're doing when we're setting up policy. And he's trying to let that be driven by his theological commitments, specifically the responsibility to Christ that we meet in the neighbor. And so this house fire or city fire is gives us a way to say we're trying to stay away from it ourselves, but there are such a thing as firemen, and they are putting themselves in extra risk, and Christians should be doing both of those things all the time, and that's what their faith should look like.
Yes, it's a very interesting analogy, because the commonest analogy which we got was of a warfare, wasn't it? This is a battle with this foe that is going to destroy us, destroy our economy, destroy our lives, destroy our well-being, and we've got to fight and muster our resources. And I remember at the time that a number of virologists, Christian scientists, and others saying, you know, this is not a helpful analogy. You know, the virus is not malevolent. The virus is doing what viruses do. And therefore, the analogy of warfare is not particularly helpful. And it was very striking, I thought, that this the analogy of a fire in some ways is much more helpful. It's, of course, it's still highly destructive, and it spreads, and you decide whether to flee or whether to join the fight against it. But in a sense, it's a natural hazard. I mean, it must have been in those ancient cities, of course. They knew that a spark could also destroy a city, like as happened in the Great Fire of London.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I find it a really resonant image, even at the biological level, because something like plague is the spread of an organism that is killing the host, right? So the fire is a good thing when kept in the hearth, but when it gets out to burn the other combustibles that make up the house itself, then it's got to be dealt with, right? So that's the analogy with the virus, that viruses are just part of what it means to be living things. So you can't demonize the virus any more than you can demonize fire, but it can get out of control. And in that circumstance, there's going to be a range of strategies that are all important. But it's different than a war, in that a war justifies do or die mentality, because it's going to kill you. It's us or them. A fire is rescue all you can and stop the actual cutting edge from spreading. And I think that just is closer to the biological and social phenomenon.
And I think it sheds the theological questions in a helpful light as well, because it seems obvious that there's no special Christian virtue in standing there as your city block burns and being consumed by fire for no purpose. But it also seems clear, and we instinctively lionize people who run into burning buildings, put their own lives at risk to rescue their neighbors, loved ones, or even more so strangers. And we, you know, create medals and put up statues for people who lose their lives in the process of this. And I think that is it's a really helpful analogy, because it elucidates that there's no great Christian virtue in seeking to catch the plague recklessly or rashly, but at the same time, abandoning those who are suffering to save yourself clearly isn't virtuous. I think it's really, really enlightening.
So just, at the end of the workshop and hearing you, Brian, and also the a very rich discussion that we had and different perspectives and so on, I think we all felt there was something really important here that we need to try to communicate to the church, because the overwhelming sort of emotion is, when it comes to the pandemic, is let's just try to pretend it didn't happen. Okay, it was a terrible time. Yeah, terrible things happened. Yeah, we all know. Yeah, but let's just, you know, let's move on. There was this extraordinary sort of outburst of people just wanting to travel, wanting to spend money, wanting to, you know, do anything just to sort of pretend it never happened. And yet it does seem to me, you know, we are expecting another pandemic. It's going to happen. It could happen within the next few months, God forbid. You know, it could happen this coming winter. Is the church any better prepared? Would it be possible to have some of these lessons more widely discussed? I'm not aware of other fora in which this is being discussed, and it does seem to me there's something very important here.
Yeah, I really valued the Faraday conference in Cambridge. I thought that was incredibly eye-opening and important. If one thing that I would love these conversations, even as few as they are, to provoke among Christians is, in a world where the experts are deciding what counts as an emergency and how to deal with it, the kind of rule of expertise and all of its power was on display during the pandemic. The right response to that is not to say the experts aren't going to ram stuff down our throat and become anti-science, right? That's one response that happened in some faith domains. I think the right response to that is to ask harder questions about what we're bringing to the table. What is our expertise? What do we have to say? And I do think we have to say something. We have something to say. And I don't think we said it in the last episode. So I would hope that this reflection, however fitful it is among, you know, theologians and pastors and journalists, would lead to Christians having a sharper view of what they might say about what's important about faith and about church in the context of a life and death emergency like this, and to pick up the banner, primarily for the gospel, but also for those that Christ actually cares for in a society, who, in the kind of war metaphor, we're looking for the cheapest way to survive this, and we're going to sacrifice what we have to. And in the rescue from a fire metaphor, we're trying to really take care with how we can, for instance, rescue children from the lifelong damage of, you know, having a whole period of isolation, sometimes in, you know, scenes of domestic abuse, et cetera, right? Like, there's a lot of damage that came. We talked about mortality and morbidity. The whole logic of our discussion publicly and in the policy was about minimizing morbidity, mortality, and we had almost no discussion about minimizing morbidity. And I think a church that's being itself will have much more to say in defense of the things that are good and important in human life below the level of simply surviving. I think that was really foreshortened in the way, at least in the UK, we responded to the pandemic.
Yeah, I think that's really, really thoughtful and pressing. And you'd hope, if nothing else, the experience we had in COVID surely should have, you know, get people's juices flowing to actually dig into some of this stuff. You know, I don't have much faith that our governments are learning lessons and have got much better pandemic preparedness policies in place. But maybe us, the church, could actually start to do some thinking ahead of time this time and get ahead of the curve rather than kind of waiting to always react to where, you know, the science lands us or the state. I mean, just one other random thought before we close. We talked earlier about the distinction across the Atlantic and how the American church leaned towards a kind of disobedient kind of, we don't want to obey what the state says. It's more important to hold on to our freedoms to worship. And the UK church was very compliant, cowed, you could say. I think you saw the consequences of that with the vaccine conversation in quite a different light, where mostly the vaccine conversation we had in Britain remained grounded in good ethics and science, and very small numbers decided on kind of principled grounds they wouldn't take the vaccine, but it didn't really become a culture war in the same way. Whereas I think in the United States, large parts of particularly the evangelical church, I would argue, regrettably kind of politicized and injected a lot of toxins into that debate about vaccines, so that vaccine rates in the US were much lower. And I think the studies suggest in the orders of hundreds of thousands of needless deaths were caused because not enough people were vaccinated. So, yeah, learnings on both sides of the Atlantic, I think, for how we navigated that difficult time. But we probably have run out of time. Thanks so much, Brian. It's been really fascinating hearing some of your research and introducing us to some of Luther's thinking on plagues and some of his theology there. If people want to find out a bit more about what you're writing, researching, do you have a website or a book or something you would want to plug at this point?
I have a big book on creation and Christian ethics called Joining Creation's Praise, and I'm out and about, easily found on YouTube talking about that. It follows the first couple of chapters of Genesis to ask, what do Christians learn there about bodily life, faithfulness in relation to all the issues that are brought up in those first couple of chapters, so sort of survey of Christian ethics. They'll find some connections with some of the backdrop ideas that I've been discussing here in that text.
Brilliant. Well, I would do recommend going and looking at some of that and other of Brian's writings. And as always, you can find lots of dad stuff on his website, johnwyatt.com. And if you, for some reason, would like to read something, my journalism, you can find that at my website, tswyatt.com. And in particular, I'd recommend that you sign up for my weekly church news newsletter, The Critical Friend, which you can do for free through my website, tswyatt.com. But that's it. Thanks so much for coming on, Brian. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.